You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Richard M. Schickel, the author of IRS Whistleblower. Richard, thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Richard, I just read your book, and it's a wonderful book. The actual full title of it is IRS Whistleblower, My 33 Years as an IRS Insider. We'll show you the secrets of how to engage the IRS and win. And I want to get into that in great detail in a moment. But before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are?
I'm from Chicago, and I worked for the IRS for 22 years in Chicago, and then I came down to Tucson, Arizona, and I was a senior revenue officer, so that means I was the guy who would come out and take your bank account, take your wages, seize your house, your car, your business, whatever it was, in an effort to collect taxes. And then I retired in December of 2013. After 33 years.
Okay. From reading your book, I know obviously more about you than the listeners do, and hopefully they will also learn as much as I know by reading your fine book. But your dad was in the IRS as well.
Right. He was a branch chief, kind of high up in the IRS as a revenue agent, so the audit side. And I didn't really like the audit side. I liked more action, so that's why I chose to go into collection instead.
Okay, gotcha. And you called yourself a senior revenue officer. You actually coined that term for the IRS, didn't you?
Right, yeah, because they don't really give you a lot when you're a revenue officer. They don't give you a lot of feel-good kind of stuff. So I did write a book in IRS called Asset Recovery Guide because so many people were leaving the IRS. And then I thought, well, wow, that's special that I wrote a book on my own time and I gave it to the government. So I needed some kind of reward. So then I came up with the idea of senior. And then all of a sudden, throughout the IRS, it started getting picked up where there were senior revenue agents and senior tax examiners. Yeah, so it was kind of just something to help people.
But what you're saying is that, and again, folks will understand this once they read the book, what you're saying is the IRS is very stingy when it comes to handing out even terms like senior because they don't want their employees to think that they're anything more than, well, maybe pond scum.
That's kind of true. But it sounds funny for me to be complaining about anything, if in the book I'm complaining about anything, because I did get 65 awards over my career, which is like a record number of awards. But it just felt kind of hollow because the IRS has such a hard time recognizing quality. And that really holds all of the workers of IRS back because it's always like walking on glass. That's just not a productive sort of way to run an organization.
Yeah, of course. Now, let me just say that the book is fantastic. And one of the reasons that I loved it so much was that, of course, most of us have to deal with the IRS, and we're basically dealing with people we don't know, and we're talking to people we don't know. We have an image in our head of this IRS, but obviously your book, being in there for over three decades, put a face on this organization. And maybe for a lot of people, too detailed of a face. I consider this book perfect material for a movie.
Oh, thank you. A lot of strange things happened in my life.
Yeah, it's incredible. What the book opens up with, I'm not even going to tell the listeners, but that's amazing to begin with. Right. You know, the fire scene. But here, I want to read something, and you brought it up. I just want to read this real quick, and then I want to ask you a quick question. It says here, I was a well-respected senior revenue officer, and again, you came up with that term, senior, which the IRS uses now, with 65 performance awards. I had a silver medal from Secretary of the Treasury, I guess that's Don Regan, right?
Yeah.
And a commendation from President Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
I was a classroom instructor, coach, and author of a groundbreaking book on financial analysis, which I gave to the IRS when I retired, and you just said that was in December of 2013. I was awarded the Albert Gallatin Award, the highest honorary career service award from the Secretary of the Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
I was also a whistleblower who was punished by the IRS management for reporting cases of inequality in the application of the tax laws. I reported age and mental health, physical health discrimination, anti-Semitism, racism to African Americans and Hispanics, and abuse techniques that were being used to single out and punish taxpayers. Well, I guess asking you then, what really was the motivation to write this book? I guess all this stuff, right?
All of that, but it's not like a book complaining. I mean, because I was just identifying where I worked and how it was. There's a lot of good people in the IRS that are frustrated that they can't get much work done to help people. And then there's just some mean, nasty people that will treat people different. And I've always thought that the tax code should be enforced the same way in New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Los Angeles and even here in Tucson, Arizona. And when I got down here, I was just shocked. Like I said, with the discrimination that I saw, some people got certain deals and other people didn't get certain deals based on if they were gay, if they were Jewish or presumed to be Jewish or black or whatever. And it was like, what is going on? But that wasn't even the reason for writing the book. The biggest reason was I was outraged that the IRS pays out like $50 billion a year in refunds, false refunds to people. And I was like, what the heck? This is insane. The budget of the IRS is only $10 billion a year. And they're just writing these checks, $50 billion. And I thought, well, it's kind of like a call to action. Like, why are we allowing this agency that has such power and control over us? You know, it's like having some incompetent person in the family in charge of the checkbook. And I thought that that's something that people need to learn about.
I read about in 97, there were some huge changes to the IRS that you talked about.
Right.
I guess prior to that, it functioned more along more cohesive levels. Was it after 97 that it was compartmentalized?
Right. In 1998, yeah, they completely restructured everything, in part to stop people like me doing the things that I was doing in the book. Because when I look back now at my career, and one of the ideas that I talk about now is there's an old legal term called the king can do no wrong. And the IRS acts like they are the sovereign power, like they are the king, and nobody questions them. They're not in fear of anybody. So a lot of the things I did in my career, that's just what we did. But when you look at the Constitution and due process of law, there wasn't a lot of that going on for the taxpayers that I was working with. And once I got out of IRS, then I was like, wait a minute, what did I do? It wasn't just me. I was really good at it. You know, there were thousands of people like me. So that's why the laws were changed in 1998.
For some reason, I thought it said 97. I guess it was precipitated in 97.
Yeah, the hearings were 97.
You mentioned before about how the tax code is not applied uniformly across the country. And you said even there in Tucson. And here on page 39, you say, for instance, tithing to a church is not allowed, except in Utah, with its prominent Latter-day Saints population, where it is allowed. This is not written down anywhere. It is just standard practice.
Right.
There are many examples of local management making up their own rules as they go along.
Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. The IRS has always run that way, like I said, and nobody questions it. That's just not right. You know, it's just not right.
So. No, of course not. And you also say here that on page 32 and 33, you say that the IRS is very militaristic. We use terms like welcome aboard, post of duty, AWOL, which is absent without leave, LWOP, is that leave without pay?
Right. Just,
and we are all agents or officers. So was it like that the entire 33 years that you're in the IRS?
Yes, until 1998 when it changed, that turned it into a stovepipe. They call it a stovepipe where everything came directly from national office after that. But before that, there were districts. Almost every state had a district director, and he was the boss of that state. And he pretty much ran how things went in his state. It was like separate IRS organizations all over the country. But then after that, that's when everything was coming directly from national office. And then that's when things like all the other little problems that the IRS has had in recent years with not-for-profit organizations came out of things like that, because nobody was making local policy. It's all supposed to come from the national office. So
seems like that would make sense. I guess a lot of it has to do with the culture in the IRS. And you say here the one constant with all IRS employees is fear.
Right.
And that you felt every day the fear of doing something wrong, that they would jump all over you.
Right, and they do. I mean, whether you're doing something good or you're doing something what they perceive to be bad, it's never like a long-term thing. I remember one case where I went out and I collected as a prominent person. He was in the newspaper at least once a week, and I knocked on the door of his house, and I left a letter at his house with his housekeeper. He owed $1 million. And the next day, there was a certified check sitting in my office for $1 million. So I felt pretty good about myself that day. So I went into the manager's office and I said, wow, look, it cost very little money. I drove out, knocked on the door, and I got the check. The case is closed. And the manager gave me a negative recordation because I hadn't filed a notice of federal tax lien within so many days of receiving the case. And it was like, wait, how did this good thing turn into a bad thing? IRS is like that. A lot of contradictions.
Wow. Even getting them $1 million isn't enough for these people.
Right. And then the other employees see that too, you know, so make them reluctant to go and show off anything good that they were doing. So it's kind of like hunker down, stay hunkered down, and be productive and always get to the next case, work on the next case. You're not doing enough. And with this kind of work, it's mentally exhausting, emotionally exhausting, because I wasn't just a tax collector. It's like you get involved in people's lives. I was a marriage counselor and a social worker and a financial advisor because I had to go in and find out what went wrong in people's lives that they owed these taxes. And that was what the problem was. It's a really big burnout job.
Yeah, I read that, all the hats you had to wear. Page 26, you say here that this one manager said, you don't raise up a chicken to scratch your eyes out.
Right. Information sharing was not really big. I remember, I don't even remember if I put that in the book, but when I was first hired at grade 12, so that would be a senior revenue officer, we all shared tables, kind of like a Barney Miller sort of office. And at that time, the grade 12, who would be the senior person, they would have their own desk and their own telephone. Well, not even a desk. It was a chair, a table, and a telephone. And they wouldn't talk to the lower graded employees. So it was like, what is going on here? You don't talk to the people that are trying to learn what you're doing? I just thought that that was really funny. Looking back, at the time, it was not funny. It was stupid.
You're laughing about it now, but it was a high-stress job, as you said, and this is clear throughout the book. You see here on page 17, sometimes the taxpayers being audited would be so scared they would be high or drunk just so they could try to handle it. It says, I remember seeing one man who had a heart attack during his audit. He died right in front of my eyes. He was lying there on the floor, and his face turned black from lack of oxygen. Right. We all stood there staring at that man. Some of the other auditors tried to hurry up and complete their audits before they released other poor taxpayers who were being audited. After the ambulance left, we were told to get back to our desks and get back to work. I mean, that pretty much sums up. It's literally like a prison.
Just writing those stories down was kind of like going to my own private therapy, you know, like all those things were stuck in my head. It was just unbelievable.
Right, yeah, I was going to say that it was kind of like a cleansing for you. And that's why it's so important for folks to read this because, again, people think, well, the IRS, it's something monolithic, but it really isn't. So what would be the advantage, Richard, for someone to plunk $20 down to get this book?
The biggest part about IRS is about fear. It's not like you're negotiating with a normal creditor or an accountant or whatever. You're coming in with a fear position. Oh my God, what are they going to do to me? What are they going to find out? Am I going to go to jail? So you need to know, and that's what we show in the book, how to talk to the IRS and how to kind of take away the power that they have over you by getting yourself all together before you go and talk to the IRS. That's the biggest thing. So you have a lot of rights under the law, but you need to actually talk to the IRS. Some people are so terrified that they don't open the letters, they don't return the calls to the IRS, and then bad things happen to them. Their money is seized, their wages are seized, they lose their tax refunds. A lot of bad stuff can happen. So this book starts off telling you some of the rights that you have, because the IRS is so big that you just don't know, even when you want to respond, you just don't know what to do. So it's kind of like you need to know the secrets of the IRS, which part of it is procedural. Like, this is going to happen, then this is going to happen. You're going to get this letter first, another letter, and the third letter gets a little tougher and meaner. But when you take away the fear and then you give people hope, that was the idea of the book. Give people hope. So even if you do owe taxes, they go away after 10 years. The IRS only has 10 years to collect the taxes. So that's a huge burden off your mind, knowing that one day I'll be free. I mean, it might not be really fun times over the next 10 years, but giving people hope, that was kind of the idea of the book.
With what's happened over these past couple of years, these recent IRS scandals, Lois Lerner.
Lois Lerner, yeah.
Did you know her?
No.
Okay. She's a political appointee?
But everybody's really insulated in IRS. And this is what happened after that 1998 where the law changed. Like, it used to be I could go over and talk to criminal or talk to the audit section or the walk-in taxpayer service. And now they have them all divided up behind locked doors where you can't go and talk to anybody else. That's what I'm presuming what happened with Lois Lerner is it came directly from national office, whatever they were supposed to do. You don't find a lot of people in IRS that are brain surgeons. You find a lot of people that are really good at following orders. And IRS loves to hire ex-military, and they're really good at following orders.
Yeah, that's true. Richard, there's a lot of people out there. I don't know if I should say a lot, but there's a good number of people out there who are under the impression that the IRS is illegitimate, that the law that created the IRS was never sanctioned, it was never ratified. You don't have to pay your taxes. It's all voluntary. What would you tell these folks?
Good luck. the courts have consistently upheld the IRS. And what I try to tell people in the book and when I counsel people in my tax business is you need to take care of you. So if you take those positions that you're not going to pay, and it's possible to do that, but you're going to live with a lot of fear. You can't have a regular job. You can't have regular income. You can't own a house or a car because you're always in fear that the IRS is going to come after you. So while I respect that that may or may not have happened, it's like dealing with the reality of the moment, which is, okay, are you going to be a superhero and they're going to come and destroy your life and your relationships and everything else? So what I tell people is Congress actually gives you so many rewards by being self-employed, where you go out and have your own business. They encourage you to spend money, to try to make money. People will disagree with this, but if you do it their way, you can save a huge amount of money and you still can feel good about paying part of the military, paying part of education, whatever it is where your tax dollars are going. But it's just really dangerous if you take positions. IRS, we talk about that in the book, call them tax protesters. And this is something that also upsets me, where tax protesters are discriminated against, which is kind of strange because we have these freedom of speech, just like your newspaper is telling us all the time. You have freedom of speech, so why would you get punished for speaking up? It just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I think that probably because they're afraid that if you are allowed to speak up and more people listen to what you are saying, then more people would catch on and then it would create a bigger problem. That's what I think. I could be wrong.
No, it's true. Yeah, definitely it's true.
And I should have mentioned that if someone who gets the book goes through it, goes through the table of contents, you'll see that the most common word or the central theme of the book is one word, and it's abuse.
Right.
Did you know that that was going to happen, or when you were putting the book together, did abuse just seem to be, like I said, the central theme of the IRS?
Part of the book, like I said, is my memoir. Part of it is about how the IRS abused people and how I abused people with my official powers, and then how the taxpaying community abuses the IRS by filing fraudulent refunds for $50 billion a year. So part of the book makes you want to go down to Belize, which doesn't have an extradition treaty with the United States, and file tax returns, because the IRS will send you checks. It's bizarre. I mean, I'm not advocating that, but I'm saying, what the hell's going on here, and why isn't anybody questioning it? So that was kind of what led me through the book. And yeah, the common nexus with all of it was abuse. Power, fear, and abuse.
Have you gotten any feedback from your former coworkers or from anybody in the IRS who have read the book?
Oh yeah, rank and file people in IRS really like it because I'm able to talk, because they can't talk. They can't write anything about how they feel. They can't talk to reporters or newspapers or anything. I'm just saying kind of like what many people in the IRS already think. I haven't heard one negative from an IRS employee, and it was also pretty popular with the IRS employees union, where people would read it and be like, yep, that's how it was.
Yeah.
But that's how it is. So
pretty amazing.
One interesting comment from another revenue officer in Chicago, before he read the book, he said, did you get in the book that you had as much power as you could take for yourself? And I said, wow, that's what the book is about. It's like the more I did, the more power I had, and they reward that. I mean, IRS loves it when you're doing stuff that, like I said, now I would say violated people's due process rights. But at the time, it was like, yeah, go and do it. Do whatever you think. That was a little wild and out of control. Not good, but I learned a lot from it. And then I'm kind of repenting from part of it too, so.
Yeah, and you start the book off with, I'm a hero. And I'll end it with saying that you are a hero for doing this, not just for what happened in the first part of the book, which, like I said, the readers of this are really going to be invigorated by. I know I was. But being a hero for not just going through what you went through for over 3 decades. I know I couldn't do it. For sure I couldn't do it. But not just going through that, but then really grabbing everything that you learned and putting it into a book where people could learn from what you spent the great majority of your life doing. You are a hero, Richard, and thank you for doing this, putting this book together.
A lot of people, especially people in the tax community, tax attorneys and CPAs who also like the book, said, why did you stay? Why did you stay in the IRS? That was madness. The reason that I stayed is because there's a pension plan called the Civil Service Retirement. IRS employees were not covered under Social Security. IRS employees were the collectors of the Social Security tax, but they apparently didn't believe strongly enough in Social Security to be part of the plan. So you have to be in that system for 30 years. So it's like, I couldn't just leave at 20 years, which I might have wanted to do. You have to stay till you get your 30 years in. You come up with meeting all the characters in the book and doing the things that happened in the book. It just really can get you doing things when you look back, you think, wait a minute, why did we do that? It's not acceptable to say, well, everybody was doing it. Yeah, we know that, but was it the right thing to do? So I think that's what the book is really aimed at. How can all the people, since Congress doesn't really represent us a lot of the times, how can all the people get involved in kind of reforming the IRS to make it just a tax collector, just a tax auditor? No extra stuff, no prejudice, no, well, we're going to go after people that have opinions about the legality of the tax code. Forget about that. That's not what they're there for. They're there to collect money or prove up the returns. So anyway, that was the idea behind the book. So I hope people enjoy that. It is kind of a confession, but it's entertaining.
Like I said, it should be a movie. If there's anything that should be a movie, it's this. And I'm glad you brought that up because I have a question about that. We're talking about the uneven application of, obviously, the tax laws here. But we heard over the past couple of years about the IRS targeting these nonprofits who were actually going through the process of trying to become a nonprofit. And if they were conservative-oriented or conservative-leaning, do you believe that, they did that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like typical MO for the IRS, so...
Who would have done that? Where would that have come from?
From national office. They tell you what cases you're going to work in, which cases to do whatever. They select them in national office. So when I read the story, not knowing anything specific about that, but overall sounded like, yep, that sounds like something IRS would do. And then the funny part is that now IRS liberalized the whole process so much that anybody can apply for a not-for-profit and pretty much get it done within a 4 to 6 month period. Because the IRS hates when they're getting too much attention that they can't control. So now they just kind of flung the door open for anybody to do that. And they said, well, we're going to look at this again in 2 years. So 2 years would be like after all this blows over is what they're probably thinking.
Okay. Yeah. So when you say it comes from the national office, does that mean that it could come from the president?
I don't know about that part. It would be the commissioner. But the commissioner is kind of the figurehead. It's usually people that are like assistant commissioners, but people are making policy decisions. And all that comes from national office. So.
Right. But the commissioner is a political appointee?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this commissioner, he or she, they're going to have their allegiance, obviously, to the person.
I don't know where they get their marching orders from.
Right. It's probably logical to assume that the commissioner is working at the behest of the person or the entity that gave him the job, him or her the job.
I mean, yeah, he works for the administration, so yeah.
So this probably came from the administration. And it's just common sense. I mean, obviously, this is a very liberal administration right now that's in there. And then we might switch to a conservative one and bounce back and forth. You know, it's basically just one party anyway, right? I think they've had the White House the exact number of years, which is pretty amazing.
Right.
So then we might see then an attack on the liberal-minded organizations through the IRS. Do you think anything's ever going to get better with the IRS?
It's in a big transition right now. They're actually down to 74,000 employees from the peak when I was there was 122,000 employees. You might think, wow, that's really good. But it's not because the computer is still directing the whole operation and it can do it with a lot fewer people. That's what I suggested in the book. If you owe money, let's be reasonable and figure out, can you pay it? And if you can't pay it, can you borrow something and then pay it? Or can you come up with some way to pay the money? I mean, so what if you owe $1 million? If you can never pay it, then maybe we should take the money we can get and settle your account. But the IRS is so afraid of doing anything like that, any amnesty like that. And after a while, the IRS needs to go to the idea that they're an audit business and a collection business. So let's make some real business decisions, you know, that would really produce money, because it doesn't make sense to run it with small-minded, fear, paranoid way that the IRS is run now. It just doesn't make sense.
Right. It's a political organization, even a military one. And of course, then this is why a lot of folks are hoping this Donald Trump candidate will get in, because he'll run things more like a business. I'm glad you brought up the computer. Just briefly explain to the listeners what you were talking about. You said this big computer, I kind of get the image of this HAL computer from 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's literally one computer that runs the IRS, right? And it's old.
Right. It's called IDRS is the name. And it went online in January 1961. It was originally an IBM 360 with those big old magnetic disks. And then it was upgraded to an IBM 370. And the cool part, despite what you read about in the newspaper, is nobody can hack into the computer because it's not an online system. So the computer is in West Virginia and then a backup computer in a salt mine in Utah. And everything that goes into the computer is done in the service centers around the country. So it's a functional computer that nobody can break into. But it's not able to keep pace with the frauds because the same computer is the one that cannot figure out that they sent refunds to a place like Hong Kong. They sent 500 refunds to the same address. So that's a problem.
Not for the address in Hong Kong. Yeah. Well, as I said before, Richard, I really enjoyed the book, and it taught me so much. Books like this really open up your mind to what's happening behind the scenes that you had no clue about. Here I am paying my taxes. Of course, we're around tax time right now. What am I saying paying? I'm getting my taxes together. I'm always late. Getting my taxes together and paying, and my personal feeling is it's not my job to question the tax code. I know money needs to be brought in to obviously have the government function. I mean, how are we going to get roads done and all this other stuff? I mean, it's just common sense to me. I understand other people might feel differently, but that's my feeling. I've always paid my taxes. Like I said, I might not agree with, as you bring up in the book, how much money the United States spends on the military here in this country, which is ridiculous. Like you said in the book, it's more than the next top 10 countries combined.
Right, yeah.
But it's not my job to question that, but it's your job to educate people, which you certainly did. I strongly suggest that anybody who wants to learn about the IRS, how to deal with them, even if they're not having any difficulties with the IRS, just to learn about the history, the inside history of this organization. This is absolutely the book to get. And Richard, I want to thank you so much for all the time you spent explaining this to listeners. Like with other books that I read where people talk about issues that are a part of their lives, I feel like I know you, even though we just met. But I can say that by reading the book, I really feel like you're such a nice guy. And the way that you took all these years, I think you said it was after 16 years, you decided to really dedicate your career to helping. No more the intimidating and the threatening and take no prisoners attitude. You helped people. So for half your career in the IRS, you did what you were told. But the other half, you said, that's it. My job isn't to scare people, it's to help people. And you really helped thousands of people, and thank you for doing that. You may have helped people that I know, friends of mine. I used to live in Tucson, Arizona, so you never know. It's a possibility. But thank you, Richard, again, for taking all the time explaining this to listeners and for writing this book. And looking forward to talking to you real soon.
Okay, and thanks for all your kind words.